This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The 1986 movie Platoon is generally regarded as the film that best conveyed what it felt like to be a grunt in Vietnam. Although the film was enough to discourage anyone from fighting a jungle war, the movie's writer and director, Oliver Stone, enlisted and asked to fight in Vietnam back in 1967. He won a Purple Heart. Stone drew on his Vietnam experiences again to direct Born on the 4th of July, the story of veteran Ron Kovic. Stone also co-wrote and directed Salvador, Wall Street, and Talk Radio. He wrote the screenplays for Midnight Express, Conan the Barbarian, and Scarface. Stone is completing a new film called The Doors, about the 60s rock group, their drugged-out music, and their leader, the late Jim Morrison. Stone expects the film to be released next spring.
You know the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, break on through to the other side, yeah.
Yeah, we just finished about 2 weeks ago in mid-June.
Finished shooting it, or finished
Paris.
Editing it too?
No, finished shooting.
Uh-huh.
I had a whirlwind last couple of weeks. We're shooting like 20-hour days in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and New York. Then we moved over to Paris and shot some stuff there, and completely exhausted, and starting to edit the film. And we'll probably be... It's going to be a big editing job. It's about 25 songs. It's a huge movie, 500,000 feet. I think it's going to take a lot of special effects, actually. We did a...
Are these tripping special effects?
Tripping special effects.
Really?
And yeah, we're trying to play with colors and perception, the concept of, uh-huh. Psychological perception, how that changes, not just with tripping, but with life itself, the way things darken and lighten and shift in your consciousness. So it's a film very much about expansion of consciousness. Jim was always after that. He was always trying to get through the barriers, trying to break through the limits of life.
What did Jim Morrison mean to you?
Well, pretty much that, that he was for a PR phrase, I'd say, an avatar of consciousness, somebody who was, the theme of his life would be Break On Through to the Other Side, which is his anthem song, He pushed things sexually, chemically, philosophically, poetry. I think success for him itself was a limitation. I think that the ultimate trip for him, I use the 60s word, the ultimate limitation, the last place to go, the last frontier for him was death. And I think that, if you look at the poetry and the songs, death is mentioned frequently. He was half in love with death, as were the great romantic poets of the 19th century. And I think that was one of his visiting spots, one of his destinations.
What phase of your life are the Doors records associated with? Is it Vietnam? Is it being home afterwards?
I'd say a combination of 67, definitely 60s, late 67 in Vietnam, turning on to it with black guys, listening to it and smoking marijuana, taking acid, and R&R trips down to Australia then going over to back to the States, and there was a run there about 68, 69. They were very much. I was big fans of Jim and the Doors, and then they were never that popular. Actually, in the States, I never found them to be huge the way they were since. But they've stayed in the consciousness, and in some ways, they've become more popular after Jim's death. I talk to a lot of 17, 18-year-olds that have heard the music. And are very much with it.
What are you doing for a period feel in the film?
Oh, we hit all the bases we have to, it's amazing in 20 years what happens. I mean, I thought it would be relatively simple to shoot, but everything was a pain in the ass. I mean, every street you take over, mailboxes, cars, the clothing, the makeup on the women, for example. I was going crazy waiting for the women extras to come out, and they'd say, well, they got to put more makeup on. And then I'd cast these beautiful young women, and they'd go into makeup, and they'd come out looking horrible. And I said, something's wrong here. It's like, they said, no, this is the way the women were. They were very made up and a little bit overdressed. I mean, I don't think the styles were particularly flattering. But as I remember, they were breakthrough styles back then. They were colorful people. People never had dressed that way. It was a great moment in the film. We were in San Francisco shooting Haight-Ashbury, and we set up one whole sidewalk signage, all the streets had to be changed, the shops. And we had 500 extras in wonderful yellows and reds and blues walking down the street, and all hippies and stuff. And I looked across the street on the other side, and there were all these tourists that come and were looking. And they were all gray and black and dark in clothing. And I said, I should take my camera now, like a Godard movie, and you pan from all the hippies in the 60s. You swing across the street for about two beats, and you see like the 90s looking at the 60s, and then you go back across the street to the 60s. That would have been a great moment in the movie. I never did it, though.
Is there a character in the film who's your surrogate?
My surrogate? No. Who would that be? You
mean? I don't know. The Oliver Stone character.
Jim. Yeah. The character... I identified with him in a lot of ways. I would have liked to have led that kind of life where you're breaking on through and testing things all the time. I do in my own way. I respect him as a writer, and I think he wanted to be a director of films if he had lived. He always talked about going back to filmmaking. He was a UCLA film student before he became a rock musician.
Are you using Doors records in the movie, or the actors actually doing the singing?
No, we're going to be, we have 25 to 30 songs in the movie, and it'll be a blend of mostly Doors music, but we're going to have some new elements that are going to be introduced. Because Val's a good singer, too, so he's a lot of that live. He did all his concerts live. He's not lip syncing. It's really his voice.
So you're using some music from the records and some from the actors.
And where Val is not up to Jim's standards because it was a live performance, and we'll slip Jim in. So Jim had a great voice, and I don't want to lose that. But Val is good.
Director and screenwriter Oliver Stone is my guest, and his new film is on the Doors, and that film, The Doors, is going to open in 1991. He also made Platoon and Born on the 4th of July, Wall Street, Salvador. I rented a video of Platoon the other night because I wanted to watch some of it again before talking to you.
And talk radio, you forgot.
Oh, and talk radio, of course,
Life and death of a DJ.
Yes. So I rented a video of Platoon the other night so I could watch some of it again before talking to you. And it surprised me that before the film opens, there's Lee Iacocca standing in front of a Jeep and saying, this Jeep is a museum piece, a relic of war. And he says, I hope we will never have to build another Jeep for war. Then he talks about the soldiers and says, they were called and they went. That, in the truest sense, is the spirit of America. And then a Jeep Eagle logo comes on. Then there's a pause, and then your film starts. And I was wondering about what you thought of that kind of...
Were those the words actually were? Those
yeah,
are the
I'm
words
quoting, yeah.
Okay. I remember it being an issue. We went through the copy on it, the first copy.
So you had to give your approval.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. I had to give my approval on it, and it was involved. The first copy I found to be difficult. It was too... It embraced the Vietnam War in a way that I thought was not correct and not truthful. I think we settled on this copy as a compromise. I had mixed feelings about it. It was a heavy commercial decision for Hemdale, which is a small company. They had put up the money on the film, and they needed the backing for the video. And I didn't want to be the bad guy, and I didn't think it was an offensive message. And to be honest, I admired Iacocca for having turned around Chrysler, although he's since gotten into some problems, I gather. But I admire his can-do spirit.
This is the first time I can remember seeing a commercial on a video where the commercial, its message tied into the message of the film.
Original copy of the message was only about American boys, and I think that I told them that no, it would have to recognize the Vietnamese deaths and at least explore the concept that the other side had suffered too. So we went around on that, Madison Avenue guys.
Right, right. The main character in Platoon drops out of college, and his analytical reason that he gives one of the soldiers who thinks that, he's crazy for being this middle class kid in the war. So the reason the Charlie Sheen character gives is, why should only the poor people fight? What was your reason for enlisting?
Well, that was part of it. I felt a sense of that it was a wrong, the war was somehow wrongly fought. If only, if you could go to college to escape it, that if a war should be a democratic country, supposedly, therefore it should be fought along democratic principles. That means everybody goes, including senators' sons and the bankers' sons. And I think that very deeply bothered my sense of idealism about this country. And I did feel an obligation that I had to serve. I left Yale University, and there were other reasons, too. It wasn't just a sense of idealism. And there was personally, I did feel I wanted to see the war. I wanted to see war as a concept because I'd read about it in books and Hemingway, and I have to admit, it had a romantic appeal to me. And I knew it was going to be the last war of my generation, and I wanted to be there. I wanted to be part of the passion and peril of our times, as Oliver Wendell Holmes said, you know.
How soon did it lose that romantic appeal?
First day in the bush, you know, I cut point, I think, in the 25th, they put up the new guys right up, like in the movie. And I think I lost that sense of, you know, it was pretty, it was clear to me in the first few days that the guys there were not really fighting for an objective or with any kind of morale. They were fighting just to count the days until they left. So everybody in the unit would have, I got 85 days to go, I got 165 days to go. You know, everybody would talk about the days left, which is not the right way to, you know, to really fight a war.
Your father was a stockbroker. You'd gone to prep school in Yale. Were your parents pleased that you had enlisted? Is that what they wanted for you?
No, they were horrified. Dad was a big believer in fighting communism, and until they took his own son, you know, he didn't. No, they thought I should stay in college. I was crazy to give that up.
Was there an element of rebellion against your parents, of course, in the act of enlisting?
That was probably the third part of the whole thing. Was that it was something that they didn't want me to do, therefore I had to do it. Because, to be honest, I'd had it with my parents, you know. I'd had it with that whole way of life. Something was wrong in the American system, that as I had been educated to, and I think I was turning my back on the world as I knew it. I knew that it was, I didn't know what else there was, but I knew what I didn't want, which was to become some version of what my father was. Since then, I've grown to respect him enormously for what he's done, mm-hmm. and to see the things he went through and understand better. But at that time, I was pretty angry.
Were you a physical person, and did you feel like that you could handle yourself well physically when you got to Vietnam?
I thought I could. Yeah, I was a good athlete, and I did learn ultimately. At first, I don't think anybody's a great soldier right off the bat. I mean, combat conditions are so intense and unplanned for that you never can tell what's going to happen. And I got shot the first time in a major, in my first night ambush, I got shot, and then I got shot a second time. After that, I got pretty smart in a bush, and I started to, I could move well without being hurt. I was carrying a lot of weight. I would carry 60, 70 pounds, or sometimes less. And, you know, but there is no question that the NVA, the North Vietnamese Army, were probably the best light infantry, you know, up to that time. I mean, there were great soldiers, too. And I'm not saying we were bad. I think that we did a good job, but we were up against people that we could travel very light, you know, eat rice and didn't need hot baths or showers and didn't need hot food. You know, they lived close to the ground. We had too much. In Vietnam, we had too many support troops. It was 6 or 7 to 1. You know, we had too much rear echelon. I think the war, if assuming that it was going to be fought, and I don't think it should have, but it should have been fought more in a commando-style way, Israeli army kind of way.
This is a scene from his movie Platoon, which was based on his own experiences in Vietnam. Charlie Sheen plays a soldier who just arrived in Vietnam. This is a letter to his grandmother.
Somebody once wrote, "Hell is the impossibility of reason." That's what this place feels like, hell. I hate it already, and it's only been a week. The hardest thing I think I've ever done is go on point 3 times this week. I don't even know what I'm doing. A gook could be standing 3 feet in front of me and I wouldn't know it. I'm so tired. We get up at 5 a.m., hump all day, camp around 4 or 5, dig a foxhole, eat, then put out an all-night ambush or a 3-man listening post in the jungle. It's scary because nobody tells me how to do anything because I'm new. Nobody cares about the new guys. They don't even want to know your name. The unwritten rule is a new guy's life isn't worth as much because he hasn't put his time in yet. And they say if you're going to get keeled in the NOM, it's better to get it in the first few weeks. The logic being, you don't suffer that much. If you're lucky, you get to stay in the perimeter at night. And then you pull a 3-hour guard shift. So maybe you sleep 3-4 hours a night. But you don't really sleep.
What was the feeling about being in a jungle war that you most wanted to communicate in Platoon?
Point of view, the subjectivity, the sense of fear and chaos that you can understand what war really is, the confusion, the fact that maybe 20% of what happens in the people who get killed in a war get killed by their own friendly fire, the sense of fear and panic and heroism too. There's daily acts of heroism. There's a bonding between the men. There was very much a split in Vietnam that I noticed. I was in 4 different platoons. I was in the 1st Cav and the 25th. And in all platoons, there was like a mini civil war going on. There was sort of the people that kind of believed in it, and the lifers, and then the people that, you know, were just draftees. There was the guys who smoked a little pot, and the guys who drank too much. There was guys who liked Smokey Robinson. There was guys who liked country music. But there was generally a political split, you know. There was a certain element of racism, mm-hmm. very strong racism towards the Orientals from portions of the platoon, you know, that they were less than human. And a lot of the other guys were more tolerant and humanitarian. So I found that interesting. I kind of thought that it reflected, in some ways, the split I saw in the United States when I went back to the country.
The kind of confusion that you're talking about in the middle of a jungle war, you captured that both in Platoon and in Born on the 4th of July. Can you talk a little bit about choreographing a scene so that what you get watching it is the sense of confusion of not knowing, not being able to see, yeah. not knowing whose fire you're in the middle of or who you're firing at. But from your perspective as a director, everything has to be completely controlled to communicate that confusion.
Well, it's very important to show that confusion. Very important. You do not see the enemy very often. In fact, in the movies that I made, you see them a little too much uh-huh. because I always had to, you know, I have to compromise to some degree with the needs of an audience, but it's even more difficult to see them.
In
a movie is to bring somebody who's firing at you a little closer to camera so that you can at least see some outlines. In real life, it was probably more invisible and dirtier and even more surprising. And death is even worse than it is on the screen. I mean, death is so, you know, it's pretty ugly and it smells bad too. I got Dale Dye to work with me. He's an ex-Marine, and he was real helpful. You know, we'd walk the terrain, and you basically plot it out, do your homework. But we kept it spontaneous. We had a terrific cameraman, Bob Richardson. We had some great Steadicam operating. We did Bourne. We did completely different than Platoon.
What were the differences?
I wanted to go with a beach. I wanted to go with a yellow, blinding sky, because I worked up in the 1st Cav, up in the beach areas in the North 1st Corps. And I remember patrolling those beaches, and there were little dangers there that you don't get in the jungle. And the sense of the sun, it reminded me of Camus' Stranger, and that Kovic would lose it, you know, he would just lose it in the sun and shoot his own man, you know, because he'd be blinded by the sunspots and sort of the panic, that crazy intent. You know, you don't, when the bullet flies, the human beings all respond the same. The eyes tighten. The brains kind of go dead a little. You don't think that much, you know, when you're under fire. So we tried to do Bourne real different than Platoon because people had seen a lot of the jungles. I think that's one of the things I'm real proud of in Bourne is the ocean and the beach and the village.
Is there any one story that you would always tell the actors who you worked with in those movies about what the war was like?
No, we put them through training. We put them through training, and
right.
It was important that they not sleep. I remember in Platoon, and we put them through 12 days with Dye up in the Philippine bush, and I really insisted. I said, I don't want this well-slept look that I see in war movies. I want these guys to look tired and beaten, and you can't fake that for some reason. You can't put makeup under their eyes. You got to give them a sense of what it's like not to sleep for a year. You don't sleep in NOM. You get three hours if you're lucky. And 2 hours here, but you're always sleeping with radar on. So that's where you get that kind of vacant look, that So we put him in the bush, and we worked him around the clock. We made him, you know, pull guard and duty and sentry duty all night, and they came out. They were so angry and irritable. That's the irritability of infantry all over the world at any time. It's a given. And I think we caught that, and the guys got it. But you can never teach an actor exactly what it's like, you know. But they are very imaginative actors, and they are able to cross that gulf and imagine. But there's no substitute for actually being there.
So that's how you worked with them, really irritable, without sleep.
And yeah, you gotta. It's not an easy film to make, you know. Yeah. You're pushing the actors, you're pushing the crew. You're getting into a state where there's a lot of tension.
When you got back to the States from the war, just a few days after you got back, you were busted on marijuana possession charges, I think trying to cross the border into Mexico. And the story that I read is that your father spent about $2,500 in payoffs to get you out of prison. Is that the right story?
Yeah, I was coming back from Mexico. I wasn't going to.
Oh, I see.
I was carrying some about an ounce of grass, you know, and Nixon's border war was going on, and they were more concerned about getting the underclass of young kids than they were about ending the war in Vietnam, I think. It was an interesting experience for me because I was about 8 days out of the NAM, 8 days, and I get thrown into a San Diego federal county. It was a county jail, but it was a federal charge, and I think there was like room for 2,000 to 3,000 prisoners. There was about 10,000, 12,000 kids in there. And I really got my eyes open because I just come from like fighting with the whole underclass in NAM, and then coming over to a prison and just seeing the other side of the coin. It was like the war was at home. It was, you know, it was real clear to me that something was wrong with our system, where we're imprisoning the young, and then at the same time sending them over to Vietnam. I could see where that gap was developing that Morrison was talking about. 5 to 1, 1 in 5, no one here gets out alive, you know. We want the world, we want it now, you know. That kind of emotion was coming through that period in the late 60s. Revolution was being talked about. It was a radical time, you know. And that prison was ugly. Yeah, I mean, those kids, you know, Nixon really cracked down on hallucinogenics and marijuana because he was threatened by that freedom. He was threatened by a lot of things, and he was busy bombing Cambodia and Laos, you know, and putting kids in jail. And those kids, if they didn't have any money, you know, it was a tough system. You went up, you didn't get any public aid, and except for 6 months later, they'd show up, the lawyers show up, you'd go in front of the judge. And as often as not, I was facing 5 years to 20 years. And I basically bought my way out with my father's money. Bought my way out. My interest, my records disappeared. The lawyer came and the public aid guy and got me out. But I think he did pay off somebody's.
What did you owe your father for that?
What I owe him?
Well, emotionally.
Well, I think that started the whole war at home. You know, because I don't think that he ever understood what we had been through over there. Mm-hmm. To him, it was a police action. That's what he described it to me as when I got home, you know. Sort of like the Korea War, a police action, but call it what you want, you know. When you're in a firefight, the degree of attrition in Vietnam was very high. With that modern weaponry, an AK-47 can take out a half a unit in no time at all. I mean, the guys I see in the 25th Infantry, most of the guys I served with from September to January 68 were either killed or evacuated or wounded. You know, it was serious business out there. And I don't think my father understood the degree of intensity in that war. It kind of crept up on us, Vietnam, you know. Now all of a sudden there's a recognition that 55,000 were killed and whatever, 200,000 badly wounded, and another 200,000 are probably mentally destroyed from having fought it. So you're getting up into some pretty big numbers there.
Screenwriter and director Oliver Stone. We'll continue our conversation on the next Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.